Hi everyone, Mo here, and welcome to the More Simple Podcast. October is here, and this month we're turning our attention to something deeply important: mental health and prostate cancer awareness. It's a topic that doesn't always get the attention it deserves, but it affects more men and more families than we often realize. So throughout this month, we're creating space for honest, hopeful conversations about men's health. I'll be joined by four incredible guests, two men who have worked through a prostate cancer diagnosis and are now using their stories to help others feel less alone, and two medical professionals who share practical insights on prevention, early detection, and caring for our health as men, brothers, husbands, and fathers. These stories are powerful, eye-opening, and filled with hope. So if there's a man in your life that you love, I encourage you to share this series with him, because awareness truly saves lives. So let's have this conversation together. Now enjoy the show. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the podcast. I just want to say I'm always thankful when we have guests on the podcast, for sure, as you all know. And then I'm even more thankful when I have guests who were introduced to me by other guests or even friends of the podcast. So shout out to Dr. Talks, Dr. Kumba Kande, for this wonderful connection. So for today's episode, to get us started, I'll just start by saying that in a world that often defines men by what they do rather than who they are, today's guest stands as a rare and refreshing voice. He's a physician, a leadership coach, and a CEO of multiple organizations, including Manifold Leadership, Empower Children's Clinic, and Empower Vitality. With over two decades of clinical and leadership experience, he bridges the worlds of healthcare, human potential, and holistic masculinity. In today's conversation, we'll trace his roots from growing up in Nigeria to leading impactful organization. We'll explore his evolving definition of greatness, explore why men are often celebrated for burning out rather than balancing well, and also talk about how intentional self-care and purpose-driven leadership can coexist. So whether you're a leader, a father, a partner, or just a man trying to live with meaning, we hope you would sit, you would pull up a seat for this one. So everyone, please join us in welcoming Dr. Timi Adekwaju to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here today.
Thank you. Thank you. All right. So I guess, like we always do on this podcast, to kind of know what shapes the person in front of us. And I already have so many questions I want to ask you, right? So let's start from the beginning. Paint us a picture of your childhood in Nigeria. What was the rhythm of your daily life like? And how did that environment shape the person you've become? So basically, let's start from the very beginning.
Okay. Well, thanks once again. You know, I was born in the southwestern part of Nigeria to a family of four, and I happen to be the last born. Growing up, my parents valued education, and they did all they could to make sure that we have the best kind of life that we could possibly have. So it was an early childhood that is focused on making sure that we are learning and growing, that we also have good character, and that we are a blessing to ourselves, and we make sure that we uphold the good name of the family and are able to do good for the world.
I was just smiling. As you're talking about that, it feels like that's every Nigerian parent's mantra. Do not disgrace us, so you must do good in the world.
Exactly. It is.
Yeah, that's good to hear. So what part of the Southwest? Is it Lagos or Oyo State? Or
I was born in Ibadan. So I was born in Ibadan, and I grew up in Ibadan, even though my parents are from Ogun State. Okay. But we spent most of our time in Ibadan. We just visit other places from time to time.
Nice. My mom is from Oyo. I went to school at Oyo, and I worked briefly in Ibadan. I still have family in Ibadan, by the way.
That's a
historical, quintessential place. And you're the last of four kids.
Yes.
How many brothers? How many sisters?
The first two are ladies, so then my brother and her.
Oh. There's so many questions I have there. So last born energy, well, do you think you fall into those stereotypical last born energy people talk about?
No, I don't think so, because I think growing up, I felt as if my parents gave me more responsibilities than my siblings.
Yeah.
Maybe that is just me. And, you know, I felt as if I didn't really enjoy and take advantage of having other siblings and other people doing things for me. I have to do things for them multiple times because I am the youngest and I have,
oh,
and
yeah.
someone has to do the job. So
yeah,
I get
yeah.
to do it.
And I can imagine, depending on the gaps between you and your older siblings, you might end up having to pick up a slack one, especially if they're out of, once you start growing up, they're already out of the house, you know, maybe for like college or uni. Okay. All right. Can you walk us through your educational pathway? I'm particularly interested and curious to know about the early influences, perhaps, in addition to your parents, of course, that maybe planted the first seeds of your values and ambitions in life.
Yeah, so I went to public schools in Amoyo State, and you know, growing up there, going to public schools there, some of the schools that sometimes there are no windows,
but the teachers are good.
And you have to make good use of whatever you are given, and that's kind of what I grew up with. But when I moved into the equivalent of the late middle school and high school, I went to a secondary school called Mayflower Secondary School in Ikene, Ogun State, and that institution is a place that is known for a lot of self-reliance, excellence, and trying to drill us. It is not a military type school, but we kind of grew up
paramilitary.
In a
military.
So growing up there and, you know, meeting people from the different backgrounds and, you know, kind of observing the different cadres of people, then you know that, well, these are the haves and these are the have-nots, and you kind of being able to, even though we're all in a similar boarding house under the similar influences, you kind of know those that came from a well-to-do family and then those that, you know, they're just trying to make it by. But we have all been given a platform to study together and to be excellent. And then I realized that, you know, it's a lot of having to make sure that you do what you are told, you put effort into your studies, and then try and make something great out of your life.
So when you wanted to mention Mayflower, I just went back to my own time. I stopped by there briefly. There was this time my parents were trying to find the right school for me, a boarding house. So we went to Model College, Igbogbo, was it Igbogbo or Kankan, one of those ones. And then we went to Mayflower. I remember just, you know, seeing the students just hanging by the window. We went to the Pepe Farm. And knowing what I know about the school now, of course, the standard of excellence, but I heard it was a very tough place. And I will say this about the school. Everyone I've met from there, I've not met someone that just went through there and slacked. There's always this, you know, boldness, this confidence that came with just the way they saw the world, and they honed their craft very well. So yeah, I'll give that to the school. But man, it looks very rough.
It is very rough. I mean, going to the Pepe, so most of the Saturdays we have to do something, and you know, sometimes they could have us go and cut grass in the rubber plantation, which is difficult. But you know, if you go to the pepper plantation and you have to pick peppers and you're sweating in the sun, you don't want to mistakenly wipe the sweat off your face.
You learn after the first time. I don't know, is the school still running today? Do you know?
Yes, it is.
And the standard is still the same? I mean, because Pastor Larry has since passed away and all that, yeah.
I don't know about the standard because I haven't been there in a decade.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It's still
man. I went to Federal Government Girls College, Oyo. We didn't have a rubber plantation or pepper farm, but I don't even have the words to explain what's my experience in boarding house. If I told some of my American friends, like, oh no, that's child abuse, that's labor. I'm like, my friend, be quiet. But did we die? Anyways, thanks for sharing that. So you went through school in Ibadan, and then you made your way to Ogun State, back to your family, your parents' roots, as it were, to gain your high school education. Now, looking back through the lens of who you are today, what would you say, what were some key challenges? And I framed them as challenges, but it could be experiences, right? that actually prepared you for the work that you're doing now, even if you didn't realize it at that time? I'm asking this because we do have all sorts of listeners on the podcast. And this question, I feel like, will serve a lot of our younger audience who might see who you are today, but might not feel like, oh, you might not be relatable. But I feel like there's always something we can learn from people, especially when we look at the behind the scenes, right? So what were some of those key challenges in your youth that you'd say, looking back now, actually prepared you for the work you're doing now, even if you didn't realize it then?
I think, you know, one of the main things is that, you know, just having to face different kind of adversities growing up, either from the level of availability or unavailability of resources, and just having to do much with the little that you have. And then also at that time in Nigeria, there was a military rule that came into place. There was times that there was scarcity of food, scarcity of means of even having the fire or the electricity to prepare food, and just working through all those times. But most importantly, knowing fully well that I believe that, you know, there is greatness and there's uniqueness in them, everyone, and how do I make it come out of me? So that's some of the things. I'm also greatly shaped by my faith, and, you know, the stories reading from the scriptures, from the Bible, stories like, you know, David and Goliath, Moses, people out, just trying to, knowing that, you know, sometimes underdogs and people in disadvantaged situations can make great things. And also, I also look at, you know, different contemporaries when I see the rich people around or the people that are successful. And sometimes when I trace their origin, I realize that these people had to do it on their own, and they had to put the effort in and the work in and make great things. So growing up, I realized that it doesn't matter what is around you. What matters most is what you are able to make out of you. That shaped how I've lived for the past 7 years.
That is so poignant, and thanks for putting that so beautifully. There's something we always say on this podcast. I learned that from one of my psychiatrist friends, and he talked about meaning. And I think I picked it up along the way with one of Jordan Peterson's book about how so much of life isn't what happens to you, but how you make the meaning out of it, right? And you get to put that meaning into it, especially the not so glamorous aspect of your life or challenges that knock you down. How do you read meaning into it? And I think for most people, the meaning might come very quickly. For others, that path towards meaning or that realization towards meaning might take a long time. No matter how fast or how slow that process is, don't stop until you find the meaning. And hopefully it will be a good meaning that would maybe empower you and help, you know, soften the process as a way. So thanks for sharing that. Now, medicine is often called a calling. Did you always know you wanted to be a doctor, or was it something that evolved as you discovered more about yourself?
You know, I've been asked that question multiple times, and I'm always looking at it. And I feel like, you know, I studied medicine. One, at that time, I felt, you know, that was the highest thing that I could do. Because as at that point in time, you know, most of the brightest and the smartest students in the school wanted to go to medical school. And I feel like, you know, that's a challenge that I can also overcome and then be able to do that. At the same time, there's a part of me that just naturally love pediatrics. So I just felt gravitated towards it, even when I didn't know much about what it entails, other than it has to do with treating kids. And then also my mom is a pediatric nurse. So they at the interplay of those three factors kind of shaped it. I can't really point to one versus the other, but I know that those three things played a role in the choice of what I decided to do and why I decided to be a physician.
Okay. And if you can walk us, thanks for sharing that. You know, I was going to make a joke about how, you know, in Nigerian homes, it's like doctor, engineer, lawyer, or nothing. Yeah.
That's true.
But I love the response nonetheless. So if you can you tell us briefly just your medical pathway? So I know you said you went to La Tech, and then how did you find yourself in the US?
So I went to La Tech in Ogbomosho, Nigeria, and then, you know, going through med school at that time and going through what we have to study versus the things that are available to us to work with, kind of the patient outcomes, the things that we're reading in the textbook but not able to how to do it. My desire is to be able to achieve the utmost in my career, and I basically just made up my mind that, you know, I think I would like to be able to achieve to the best that I can do in Nigeria, but at the same time being able to explore other countries, other developed countries like the UK or the US more in particular, to be able to get to that level that I'm also certified and I'm able to practice in both settings. And that's what I wanted initially. There was that vision, there was that goal, but you know, along the other line in the med school, there's a time that, you know, there's frustration about the length of the program, about how stressful it is, about how much time that has to be invested in it. And I actually, you know, thought about it and wanted to see if I could go the public health route. So
yeah. So
I explored that as well, and I feel like that would be rewarding. And then, you know, I came to the US 3 years after finishing med school and did my master's in public health. And then I was between two options. Do I practice public health or do I
medical practice? Yeah.
And then, you know, I graduated in 2009, which was the perfect time to as a graduate because of the global
recession,
financial meltdown. Yes, there was recession at that time. There were no jobs available, and I at that time, because I did my master's at the University of South Florida in Tampa, Florida. At that time, I saw people from other careers like engineering, some commerce, marketing things, and things like that also lost their job, and many of them were going into the clinical field. So here I was being in the clinical field trying
to go into the way.
And some people are running in. Then I realized that, you know, sometimes even in the recession, you know,
things,
healthcare still has opportunities. We need to preserve the life of people and everything. So based on that experience, so I kind of pivot back and then say, okay, I am going back the clinical route. And then I started preparing for my medical licensing, and the rest is now history.
Wow. I think just hearing you say this reminds me of what you had said earlier on about when I asked you the question about challenges in life and talking about meaning, right? And being able to see those opportunities. Because, yeah, we know that global recession really hit hard, but being able to even find opportunities and, you know, learn and be very flexible, that's what I was trying to pick up. It really ties together what you had shared earlier on. So thank you for bringing that close to home again.
Yes.
All right. Now, my husband is a physician, and he did the whole thing you did as well, you know, clinical practice, and then MPH, he has an MPH. And then we decided that, okay, I wanted to push him to get a PhD, so that way we can at least have things to talk about, because we... we're always having this banter going on. You're the real doctor, and I'm the real doctor. But anyways, just a little bit of a joke. But I know for him, academic pursuits really has like a limit. But he really wanted to practice. USMLE aside, even getting residency was, you know, very, very hard. And as you know, there's a wave of come March, we'll start hearing about March, you know, and all that. But those who might be at the cusp of, you know, residency or maybe trying to find a spot to match in, or maybe they're listening from one part of Africa or another part of the world and trying to make their way here with all the immigration hurdles and all of that. Are there some tips or nuggets you might be able to recycle to support them along this path?
That's a wonderful question. For me, I've always seen adversities as opportunities.
Mm.
So I think that is the part to look at, because many people that are in that phase that they are looking for opportunities or trying to come to the country to get their do their medical residency, many times a lot of people tend to focus on the challenges. I'm not denying that there are challenges. There are lots of challenges. There are lots of statistics that say what percentage of the international medical graduate
IMGs,
sport. But my question is, so why wouldn't I be part of this sport? What are the people that are getting those sports doing that I need to know how to do? How are they going about it that I need to go out to do? And it all comes, you know, believing in yourself, believing in, you know, your network, support structures, having the spiritual, mental, physical strength to be able to push through, and then just putting all those forces together. Because I believe, you know, like they say, you miss 100% of the shots that you don't take. But, you know, if the 100 shots, you could get some in and you could get nothing in. But for me, the best part of the day or the best part of thing is to know that I have fully given all the best of my efforts to what I want to accomplish. Because that is something that anyone can do.
Thanks. Did you find your... And you got your MPH before you matched into residency, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Did you find it useful to go that route? Or if you were to do anything differently, what would you do differently?
I believe it is useful because there are some programs that actually kind of look at people that have had some form of education in the US. Because, you know, the education standards around the world is very different.
Different, yeah.
When they see that you have done something internal, there are some programs that value that, some don't. But I think, you know, it also helps because doing the master's gave me an opportunity to be within the system, within the country, and also use that opportunity to possibly get some externships or some observerships, network with people around, because it is easier to get things done when you are proximal sometimes than when you're far away.
I like that. And you're right, you wouldn't know what's... Basically, sometimes you don't see the forest for the trees, but keep going, right? You don't know what kind of experiences or even ventures might come in handy for you. So we're not saying everyone should go get an MPH. It could even be shadowing or volunteering at a lab or getting some form of research experience. And I've shared this a bit on my podcast, but I'd like to bring it up again. But my husband, he got his MPH and then finally finished his residency. And then when it was time for him to begin, got his MPH and then he matched just right as it was concluding his MPH, which was fantastic. And then we're trying to get his program wasn't super IMG focused. So all of this visa, whatever, was very complex for them. But luckily for us, then we were applying for a green card. So he had, and we did a concurrent filing, meaning that he got his work authorization at the same time while his case was, our case was still being adjudicated. So it was that card he used to just say, hey, I have a pending green card application, but once approved, I can update my, but for right now, this is what I have. So he starts residency. And tell me why it smacked up. No, let's say 1 month into, no, we started in March. In August, we got, no, it started in July, sorry. 1 month into his residency, the case was denied. Lawyer botched it, totally different story. And think about just the panic. We knew what it took to finally match. And then knowing that he has to go tell his employer, hey, I'd like to withdraw my EAD because it's no longer valid. But what came through for us, and I always say thank God for community, one of our Nigerian friends had, you know, introduced us to a lawyer of his who was his pastor. Shout out to Wale, by the way. And the pastor was just like, why not just let him file for his OPT using his MPH degree? And that way he can present that to his employer and say, hey, you can create a project for me. I'm no longer going to be a physician doing MPH work, but I'll be an MPH person that can do clinical work. So they crafted, and they did that. They've never, I mean, this was a program in New Mexico, by the way. They had never done, because of him, they went into E-Verify, which has a lot of implication because that region of the country had a lot of immigrants just, you know, coming in from Mexico. So going on E-Verify puts them at risk of getting audited, you know, quickly. But they did a lot of that for him. And he was able to stay, and then we finally got a green card. All that to say, I'm glad he got his MPH, because if he didn't get it, mm-hmm. it would have... But you, at that time when he was doing his MPH, we had no idea it was going to come in handy. So I just wanted to add to what Dr. Adepo just said. Just keep going, you know, keep going. It might not make sense now, but a lot of things in life, because we were so one-dimensional as human beings. We don't have that gift of, what's the word, multiple insights, you know, the past, the present, and the future. We're not omniscient, right? So, yeah. Okay, let's go to leadership. You have done a lot. And one of the things I talk about on the podcast, because I really like to have a lot of men. We don't get to get a lot of men on the podcast. So whenever I have, I like to, like, you know, shape that. Now, the word greatness gets thrown around, right? And gets thrown around a lot. But how do you personally define it? And how do you separate true greatness from mere success?
Greatness for me is when the vision you have for yourself matches what you accomplish, and then it's also beneficial to the world. So a lot of people define success in many ways, either by the academic degree or by the finances or by the kind of house they live, or by being able to afford different luxury items. And there are also different parameters of success, which is what someone wants to achieve. And if they achieve it, they can be successful in that. But when it comes to greatness for me, it's merging your achievement with your desire in a way that also benefits the world. So, for example, there could be a lady that is listening, and all she wants to do is to have a good family, being able to make sure that her children are properly raised and they are a big value to the world. Mm. Her name may not be on the Forbes list, or her name may not be out there, but what if she's able to do that? And that gives her an immense sense of satisfaction for raising a strong family in the middle of a corrupt world. Then that, for her, she would have achieved greatness. So when I look at greatness, you know, people look at me, oh, I'm a physician and I trade in Nigeria, and I'm now here in the United States, and I also got my degree, and I run a couple of clinics. Some people look at it as greatness, but, you know, there are people that we've looked at that have achieved a lot, but they are still sad. They are still depressed. Some are even, unfortunately, committed suicide because, you know, whatever they have achieved or whatever people see didn't match the internal drive that they have, didn't really feel the internal void that they have. So greatness for me has to combine what you have within you with what you have achieved outside, and also to the good of humanity.
I like that. I think it's also, in addition to just filling those stereotypes of, if I could just explain what you're trying to say, is instead of just trying to fit into the stereotype of checking the box, is that personal fulfillment, but also doing a greater good.
Yes.
Right? Mm. Now, what would you, like, leadership for me, I feel like there are all kinds of level. Like, there's that personal leadership, which we should all, you know, strive to lead ourselves first before we can lead others. What would you say has really helped you to hone your leadership style as well? Perhaps maybe self or professional, or even how you show, you know, for others?
For me, my leadership journey with the desire to lead myself. Because, you know, like I said from the beginning, I was the last born. There is no way I could lead my siblings.
Yeah.
And then also
try it.
Going through the school system, I never really held any leadership position, but I know that I'm absolutely responsible for the outcome of my life. So
yeah.
That just drove me in the sense of being able to lead myself, being able to put myself in a position, even that when I'm under the leadership of others, I'm able to guide myself in the right direction. So, and that, you know, led me to, you know, reading a lot of leadership books, just knowing that, you know, there is, if there is greatness in me, I have to be the one to bring it out. And I would bring it out by, you know, investing time and resources in just learning and knowing how things are done, knowing how the leaders communicate, knowing how they lead their lives, knowing how they plan their time, knowing how they prioritize things. So many aspects of success that has to be just learned. So leadership for me is mostly personal. And now, as an outcome of those personal development efforts, I now found myself eventually in situations where I need to lead others. So that was just a continuation of the personal leadership investment in myself.
Thank you. So what books would you say or processes have shaped your leadership style?
Oh, talking of books, I've read tons of books. Growing up, you know, having to read, you know, things like, you know, The Purpose Driven Life, Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, how to influence people. You know, growing up, read so many of the, you know, Brian Tracy, John Maxwell, Ogmandino, Tony Robbins, just kind of just whatever things are out there. And then, you know, I also grew up in a low resource setting. So some of those books were sometimes borrowed. Apologies to the author. Some of those books were initially just photocopied.
You open it, you have to be very careful because the binding material just listened to you. Ah, God help us.
Yes.
God help us.
The photocopy, but you know, and you know, I'm now happy that, you know, now I'm part of the John Maxwell certified team.
To their
conventions, and I'm now happy, you know, that okay, some of the materials that I used to photocopy, I'm able to actually buy
and
able, you know, take a picture with John Maxwell, go to Tony Robbins event. So it's a lot of personal investment, and I feel like if anyone wants to go that direction to build themselves, I don't want anyone to be limited by the geographic location that they are. Thanks to YouTube, there are a bunch of free YouTube resources. There are a bunch of books that we can buy on Amazon, and then just wherever you are, you can start making efforts to just learn a little more, just know a little more, add value to yourself day after day, and it all just compounds to bring the greatness out of you.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. And I know we can also add those resources to the podcast episode whenever we're publishing it. Now, you have done something quite unique that I like to highlight, in that being able to merge your clinical practice, clinical care, and leadership development, right? And do you see parallels between diagnosing illness and also diagnosing organizational challenges?
Yes, there is some pattern, because, you know, one of the things that I learned from my leadership development is that, you know, one of the best ways to make quick decisions is to be able to recognize patterns. And not everything would fall into stereotypes, but, you know, if you are able to recognize certain patterns, then you are able to know what to accomplish. And so clinical medicine is a lot of, okay, there's the symptoms, there are the things that you find out in the examination, there's some things you're looking for in the laboratory investigations to come up with your differential diagnosis, and then to have a standardized plan. So with leadership development as well, there are different things, just like it could be in communication, teamwork, effective marketing, bringing people together. There are common denominators that served most scenarios, but then you have to be able to look at what situations you are in and kind of properly diagnose, so to speak, or find out what needs to be done for that particular scenario, and then to apply the effective leadership principles. And sometimes, maybe when it comes to employee, it could be just walking in their shoes. It could be finding out more about why a high performer is now seeming to be
struggling. Yeah.
Struggling. Mm-hmm. Or maybe, and then sometimes it is just coaching. Sometimes it is just letting them be, because they are not ready for the conversation.
Yeah.
So there could be is the same scenario, and there could be four or five different ways just based on what you find out. So I believe that the leadership and clinical aspects for me, it has really helped, because I'm able to look at the same symptom, but then I kind of come with different differential diagnosis and different way to approach it.
Thanks for sharing that. So one thing, I mean, I'm in leadership, and I know how alienating that can be, especially when you're starting out and then all of a sudden you branch out in a way, you become like a snitch, or your colleagues might look at you like, eh, we can't trust this one, even though you're still aspiring for the goodness in others. I think a classic example I'll give was when my husband was doing his residency, they were all residents, and then they had to vote for chief president. He and his other bestie, they both ran and then they won. And all of a sudden, it was almost like night and day. He talked about how, you know, lonely it was, and when he would try to advocate and make changes, it was super, super hard. And that also helped him learn a lot about just people management, which, as you know, it's very, very tough. Now, how do you find support as a leader, especially when you are the one others turn to? And in spaces where there's that switch all of a sudden from people being your buddies to now people not trusting you because you're now the admin. You know, we don't trust the admin. We don't trust the HR. How do you make those adjustments internally? But also, how do you find support as a leader, especially considering how lonely it can feel sometimes?
It is a very difficult position to have to be in. And I think, you know, sometimes some people kind of wish that they don't get to that position where they get into that administrative role. Because, you know, everybody knows that once you are the administrator, then things change.
Yep. But
for me, the most important thing is to make sure that the people under my leadership know that I'm there for their best interest, and making conscious efforts for them to know that, okay, this guy is the administrator, but he has our best interest in our mind. You know, talking to them at their level, knowing that, hey, this is what we need to do. This is how we need to approach this. But, okay, how can we help each other? How can we help you? What is going on? And just being at their level. And also, you know, sometimes some people would open up to that approach, but some still wouldn't open up because you are the administrator. Finding allies among the people that you're leading that, you know, people can bounce off ideas with them, and then those ones can give you the feedback. So to get the buy-in of as many people as possible, but then I also leverage the ones that I get buy-in from to be the representative. So kind of, if something comes out from me as the leader, to tone it down if it's too hot to the level of people that I'm leading, so that we would all be on the same page and we would all be able to move forward together.
Yeah. I mean, I think the key thing here is self-awareness. Like, a self-aware leader is so, so great, because you tend to see what it's like to be on the other side of you, right? And the way my coach explains, your left hand, right hand. Your right, if you're straight, you're a dominant right-hand person. Your left hand, there's only so much you can do. But then you complement those deficiencies with people who have the skills that you want. But also knowing your own limitations as well. Maybe there's a way you tend to say things that you might lose half of the room. How do you balance that out? Okay. And then adjust it as you go, right? Yes. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah. A key aspect of leadership for me also is personal feedback. So every meeting, everything, just kind of, okay, what could I have done better?
360-degree, right? What you call it, yeah.
Then they did better. What do I need to do the next time? Do I need to sandwich it? So the people that have worked with me, especially in the last 4 or 5 years, they could see that, you know, there's been a lot of growth. So instead of just attacking something right up front, you know, calling them and appreciating what they've done in the past, and now you appreciate them, and how, you know, for us to move forward, there is this new issue, and I think it might be better if they approach it this way. And then also understanding the different generations that we're dealing with, because what you
word. Oh, and even the culture too, because in Nigeria, I feel like we're very direct.
Yes.
You say it.
Mm-hmm. very direct. Now you need to know how to tone it down, how to praise, how to appreciate, how to present it. But the most important thing for every leader to know and everyone in that scenario is that you need to be able to focus on the vision and the goal. So the approach can always vary, and then you are able to be malleable enough, and hopefully the people that you're leading see that you are considerate, you are malleable, you are flexible, you're trying to be as much, and those that would align with them align, and you'll be happy. And unfortunately, to be realistic, some still would not align, and you need to find a way to keep moving forward.
That's just it. You're not jollof rice. You can't even appease everyone. Heck, some people don't even like jollof rice, you know. So just do your best. I think if you can, the danger we run into is trying to please everybody or trying to make decisions that can make everybody happy. As long as it aligns with the vision, which I'm very glad you talked about, aligns with the vision, you're consistent, and you take ownership of mistakes you make, and you show what that growth looks like. Like, hey, you know, I dropped the ball in this area, or I shouldn't have said it that way. Let me work myself back from the situation. And most people, they will fall in line and follow, you know, but not everybody. And that's okay. You can appease everybody. Yeah. Whew. All right. Let's talk a little bit about men's wellness, right? Was there a stat I read somewhere that 7 out of 10 men experience symptoms related to stress, anxiety, or depression? Yet less than half of them seek help. Meanwhile, men are also 2.5 times more likely to die from preventable diseases. I study health policies, I do global health, and whenever there's this chat on, you know, mortality around the world, like lifespan and all that around the world, and we always compare age adjusted as well as gender, and everywhere across the world, I mean, for example, in developing countries, you see that the average age of life expectancy is lower compared to that of developed countries. But if you look at the within group differences across board, men die faster than women, right? Now, we know that men, perhaps is social grooming or conditioning, they take immense pride in being providers. Sometimes they wear exhaustion like a badge of honor while also neglecting their own health and well-being. My husband, despite being a physician, it took a lot of and rigging for him to be doing his yearly checkup, which is now better. So thank God for that. So from your perspective as both a physician and a leadership coach, why does this self-destructive pattern persist? And how do we, I don't want to say help, because that sounds very demeaning in a way. How do we support our men to liberate them from these expectations of wanting to provide us at the expense of their health and well-being? Being a provider is great. I have nothing against it. But it's when it's done at the expense of their health and well-being, which ends up putting their families at risk because they might die early, and then all of that, you know, puts a wrench in the whole plan.
That's a great question. I think one of the areas to start looking at it is that I think most men are wired to be providers, and they take pride and honor in being able to be there for their family. Most men would rather sacrifice their time, their health, and everything just to make sure that the family is comfortable. And, you know, unfortunately, with the demands of the personal expectations and the societal expectations and the family upbringing, among other factors, we men all tend to want to do that to the extreme, to be able to say, okay, I could provide, to the point of, okay, I can provide even though I don't get to enjoy it. So they are working so hard, and you know, there's the, so that people can have a availability of resources, luxury, but even when they are able to, they may not make it to the vacation, or even when they make it to the vacation, they are just so exhausted that they are not really enjoying them and the benefit of them. That calls for like a big conscious effort on the part of each of the men. And then, you know, encouragement from all the supporting group around to make sure that, hey, there are certain things that as good as you being productive and trying to provide. So you taking time off to rest, it's being productive and being there for the family. You taking time to switch off is part of being productive and being there for the family. You taking time to just breathe is a part of being there. So, and also having certain things in place, say, hey, we need you to do your yearly exam. your annual exam. We need you to find time to make sure they are resting well, adequate nutrition, vitamins and mineral supplements, gym. And so all those things, those are the things that every man needs to know, that you are not really doing yourself a great benefit if you are not taking care of yourself. And you need to balance the desire to keep going and acquire and achieve and obtain more with with your personal well-being, to be active and alive and healthy for the people that you care about.
Thank you for that. For you, what does that practicality look like? Like, how were you able to? Because I know one of the biggest things that you do, which is why I brought in the podcast, is having that healthy balance, right? Family life, work life, personal and professional development. What were some practical steps you had to take to ensure that harmony?
For me, it's been challenging, but I think, you know, there are different phases in my life. I'm an entrepreneur, so sometimes working 80-100 hours a week is the norm, because like my wife says, sometimes I don't really switch off. So it is left to me to know that, okay, there are times that I need to switch off. There are times that I need to take a break. There are times I need to go for vacation. So I try to make sure that, you know, 2 to 3 times a year, I go for vacation. I try to make sure that most things that I have to do, my Mondays to my Thursdays are pretty busy. Once we reach Friday, except if there's an emergency that I need to go step in, I'm kind of all eased out. Weekend, taking like a day of rest, like complete day of rest, and knowing that, okay, and this time I'm not working, I'm just relaxing, resting, yeah, and then rejuvenating. Having a bunch of supplements that I take that could help with different aspects of my health, my gut health, cardiovascular health, brain health, supplements that help with relaxation. Those are all some of the things that I incorporate now. There are also, we also need to be conversant of different times and phases in the life. There are times that, okay, maybe there needs to be a new business that is being built, a new acquisition that could bring in a lot of stress and a lot of work. But then knowing that, okay, even in this time that is time and capital intensive,
yeah,
effort intensive, to find moments that maybe go for a walk in the evening, focusing on your breathing, just tuning off during those times. And then knowing that once you finish that intensive phase, that you have time to just take a vacation, just take a rest, just take care of yourself. Because at the end of the day, when we all look back, there are things that we would all wish that we have done better. So the goal is to start now to say, okay, what are the things that I would wish that I would have done better? And let me start doing it better from now. Whether it's the time with family, time with friends,
yeah,
time to relax, and incorporating that into our daily routine. And whenever things get out of balance, we don't necessarily need to blame ourselves. We just need to come back to the place where we re-achieve that balance for ourselves.
I like that. It seems very practical. And I know there can be men saying, oh, I don't have time for vacation, I don't have the luxury for vacation. It doesn't have to be climbing an airplane to get somewhere. It could just be a personal retreat. It could be, you know, taking a road trip to the next city or the next town and relaxing a little bit, stay in a hotel so that way you don't have to worry about cooking or doing your laundry. Just little things like that. Once in a while, like once every quarter, do that to your body. And then do your yearly checkups. Know your numbers. Those are very, very important things. Now, so let's talk a little bit about leadership as we're winding now. I mean, we're probably going to spend a lot of time here. So you have multiple entities that you oversee, right? You're juggling vision, strategy, and the relentless demands of daily operation. How do you maintain clarity and prevent one role from cannibalizing the others? And I ask this because people that fall into that multi multi-hyphenate. You know, like you can't just do one thing. You know, you're very great at so many things. Sometimes it's really hard to like balance and not let one kind of like, you know, overshadow the rest. So what are some of the practical steps you take to maintain this clarity and prevent one role from overshadowing the rest?
I think, you know, there are times that one would overshadow because of maybe some challenges going on. But as a general broad frame, to have particular times for each aspect would be very good. And then also to have a lot of system and support. System means that so many things that I need to do or that people in those similar scenarios need to do are put into a certain framework that everybody and everything knows how it is done. There's a standard operating system, and that not everything requires me to come in as a decision maker. There will be things that are going off that they need my input, but not input for everything at every time. And then also carving out particular times to work on particular projects. And this is what I like about planning and goal setting. I was joking with someone yesterday, you know, sometimes I have my weekly plan, and once Monday comes in, different things just come in and they just want to just take over the time and take over everything. And many of those things need to be addressed because they are probably urgent and they need you. But at the same time, you know, maybe starting your day early, knowing the things that you have to do for that week, it may not necessarily fall on a Monday, and then making sure that within pockets of time, you're able to address the critical parts of things that need to be addressed. And just building the good support system, people that you trust, people that help you to get your vision done so that you don't get torn in too many places. And if you feel like you're getting overwhelmed, I have learned to know that the world will not crash if I don't show up on a day.
Yeah.
So,
but that's the hook though. Like, it's like, if I don't check that email, why do we always do that to ourselves? Like, if I don't show up, if I don't do this, then everything is going to come crashing down. Is that not the lies we tell ourselves?
Yeah, and I think that's one of the mentality, because a lot of us those kind of leadership or people that are just responsible for what they are doing are so invested in the success.
That's why we join it, right?
that investment sometimes tend to consume us, but it is not meant to consume us. It is meant to help us. So we shouldn't let that desire hijack every aspect of our lives. Rather, we should just learn to just balance everything as it goes on.
I mean, it's freeing on so many levels. And thank you so much for sharing that. So if I remember, you said you're married, right?
Yes.
Congrats. And how long have you been married for?
6 years.
Okay. Any kids?
Yes, I have a 4-year-old.
Oh, that is cute. Yeah, I have a 6-year-old and now a 9-month-old. So how would you say your partnership with your wife has been very helpful in doing all you do? Or even just, you know, having your own family now?
And my wife is a career person too. She's a pediatric cardiologist. And
wow, couple. Wow. Congrats.
Sometimes busier than I am because of the demands of the work and academic setting. And then, you know, one of the things that I had mentioned earlier, you know, concept of the greatness, like for me, what do I want to do? So I want to make sure that I have time with my son. So anytime that, you know, I have to maybe drop him off or pick him off, or the weekends that we spend time together, making sure that, okay, I know what he wants to do, what he likes to do, and we're able to make sure that our weekends and the time that we're together is invested in the things that he likes to do. He knows that I am there. And then, you know, sometimes maybe there's a meeting that is popping up on the time that I should be having with him. If it's something that I can postpone, that is within my ability, I can do that. If it is not, just kind of letting him know ahead and negotiating with him, say, hey, between this time and this time, daddy will not be available. But before that time, we would go and do this. After that time, we would go and do this. And then just managing expectation and just being there for the family as a whole.
Thank you. Those are, you know, tips. Especially if you know that sometimes your work might take you away from home. But whenever you're there, just trying to be as present as you can, right? I put a panel together the other day, and one of the panelists, she's Gigi, by the way, her name is Gigi. We call her Gigi. She has 6 kids. And there's something she said about knowing that for their family, they couldn't attend all of their kids', you know, events. And what they just did was they relied on their community to sometimes help support that. But the ones they attended, they made sure that they were there fully present. And they will also advise their kids, like, you can do many activities, but just choose one that we can, because our time is only so limited, right? And the kids understood, but it's also being having those conversations and being frank with yourself, like, what is my bandwidth? But whenever I'm here with you, I'm going to be here with you. But I cannot attend all of your stuff because, you know, I have these other things. And I think if we're being just, you know, honest about our bandwidth and explain and modeling what that balance looks like, it puts the human in everything we do, especially parenting. I think so.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. All right. So as we're rounding off, I still wanted to tease your brain a little bit. Now, what's something about leadership you wish more people would talk about, honestly? Maybe something you've learned the hard way.
That's a tough one. For me, I think the most important part of leadership that I would like people to talk more often is the humanity in leadership. Knowing that, okay, as a leader, and the things that I've talked about, I'm not perfect. I am leading you. I am in that position either for one reason or the other, but I'm also not perfect, and I'm also working on myself every time, which is one of the things that I mentioned earlier. When I have some of those conversations, I kind of go back and say, okay, well, maybe I should have done this. And sometimes after some of those conversations, I kind of have to send a message to the person that, hey, I just want to appreciate this. Thank you for the time. And just knowing that, okay. Or sometimes I just come and say, well, I said it this way. This is what I meant. Maybe I should have said it. And just sometimes when you, as a leader, go back to the people that you're leading, and you go and apologize for something, it just shows that, you know, it's a form of vulnerability, but it also shows that you have enough self-esteem within yourself and you're able to just keep improving. So the way that I see, like, the people that I've had the opportunity to lead for the past several years, I'm like, well, this version of me that you see today is much better than the one for the last 2 or 3 years. But it's also still a work in progress. By the time you see me 2027, I will be way ahead of where I am now in many things that I'm doing. So just bear with me. Okay, this is what we have to do. This is what I did wrong. This is what I did right. And just keep improving as a leader.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, thank you. Those are very great steps to follow through. It's really the key to self-awareness. The next question for you will be about just looking back over your journey, right? What was one piece of advice you received that you are glad you completely ignored? Sometimes I feel like the best guidance is knowing what not to follow. I mean, we always talk about what was the tip that helped? The one that you gladly ignored. I'd like to hear that.
That's a tough one because I'm trying to think
about the ones, right?
The one that I needed to have to do. You know, when I decided to, growing up, when I decided that I wanted to go into medical school, I was told that, you know, that I shouldn't do it. And the rationale was that it would be a lifelong studying. It's a lot of time. It's a lot of effort. And that I shouldn't do it. But for me, when I heard that kind of advice, what I took it as, okay, are they questioning my ability to be able to get accepted into medical school or to do it? So I interpreted that, and a lot of things is our interpretation of the advice that was given to us. My interpretation was that, okay, maybe they felt that I couldn't do it. So I went ahead and I did it. And of course, there were times in a med school, because my brother studied engineering, and, you know, within a couple of years it was done. I'm like, oh my,
wow, why
this medical school thing? We are still not done. And then, you know, medical has been in at the medical field, you admit there's a lot of fear that, you know, if you make a mistake, someone's going to die, you might be sued and things like that.
Yeah.
A lot of fear.
Litigations, yeah.
Yeah. So I am happy because, you know, with certain things that I didn't accept because of the perspective and the interpretation that I give to it. And, you know, some of those advice, I feel like the people giving the advice are actually saying or giving that to the best of their knowledge. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the best of their knowledge may not really match with the vision and the goal and the things that you are supposed to achieve for your life. So I, looking back, I would thank them for that advice. And I also thank myself for not taking the advice.
Taking the advice, yeah. Discernment is key, you know. I remember when I moved to the U.S., one of the things, an old elderly couple that are godparents and family friends all said us, be very careful who you receive advice from, because people will give you advice, but they are sowing that seed of frustration, not intentionally, you know. Like when most of Nigerians come here and everybody goes, says, go and study nursing. What if nursing is not the path for you? But, oh, no, you make money with nursing. Like, is that the only, you know, mission? And to them, maybe it's just a way to make money. But for you, your mission might be something greater. Again, thank them for the advice, but make sure you discern the kind of advice. Because people just give you advice based on how they suffered. Mm-hmm. And they just say, oh, don't do that one. Or if you do it, or don't apply to that job, or they don't take, you know, immigrants.
And that's actually one of the advice that I got when I came to the U.S. Someone told me, why are you trying to do this thing? Just go and do nursing. You'll get on everything. And I felt and the person probably knows many doctors that have come and have not been able to get a residency and the years of frustration and pain and everything. Yeah. And I felt as if, you know, that person actually gave me the best advice that they could have given me. So I appreciate them for it, but I know my goal and my vision, and I know that doesn't fit into the outlook that I have for myself, so just moved on.
I didn't even know that happened to you as well. We heard that a lot. I mean, my husband being a physician and trying to match, like, oh, study nursing, you should be fast, you can. It's like, no, I don't want to do it, but thank you. Now, thanks for sharing that. As you look towards the next decade, how do you hope your work will continue to shape lives and organizations?
Yeah, so I have been more in the clinical setting, and but I feel like, you know, even from some of these conversations today and from of the outlook, some of the insights, there is a lot that I can offer the world. And that is why we came up with the concept of the Manifold Leadership, which we will be doing our own podcast and our
And our
own training, just to help people develop their leadership capabilities. There will be outreach to one aspect of it will be for the physician or people in healthcare related fields, and another would be towards youth, just to help them know that, hey, you could do it. You can achieve the best that you want to do. So we are hoping that we are taking the values and virtues and the insight beyond the four walls of a medical establishment to benefit the whole world.
Yeah. Okay. And thanks for sharing that. I mean, and all the best with your podcast and all of that layout. If there are any ways we can support you on the podcast, please let us know. We'll be more than happy to help with that. Kind of flipped this on its head. I should have asked you earlier on. So congrats on your clinic, by the way. I think when I got your bio, I did a quick Google search, and I think it's in Mississippi, right?
Yes.
Oh, as someone who lives in Oklahoma, I'll say that Mississippi, Alabama, West Virginia, you give us hope. As far as, you know, how is Mississippi doing compared to Oklahoma? As long as we are, you know, ahead of you guys, we feel better with ourselves. Or doing education, we finally ranked 50 out of 50. You guys are finally, you know, done better. But, and I say this, you know, even though there's a lot to cry about, because these numbers are not looking good, especially when you look at, you know, health outcomes related to diabetes, obesity, just so many things. So Mississippi consistently ranks among the lowest in the U.S., for healthcare access and outcomes. There's high rates of poverty, chronic illness and health disparities, especially in rural and underserved communities. Given this context, what has it been like for you to build and lead your clinic, your Empower Children's Clinic in Mississippi? Were there unique challenges you faced running a practice there? And how have those challenges, if any, shaped your approach to building trust in the community, given that, again, for simplification, you were an immigrant in that space, right? And I imagine there were some internal and external shifts you had to make to be able to get the trust of the community. But what has that been like for you working in that region?
It's been wonderful. Like I said earlier, I see opportunities in adversities. A lot of people just complain about adversities, but I just take it on because, you know, sometimes light comes out of darkness. And so that is the way that I kind of see that, okay, this set of adversities and this set of things, how do we make the best of it? So when we moved to Mississippi in 2019, before that time, I was employed as a physician, as a pediatric hospitalist. And that's what I do. And that's what I love doing. And, but when I came and I saw that, you know, there are different challenges, like you mentioned, there's education, healthcare, poverty, and the rest. And I said, okay, which one could I be a solution to?
Yeah.
Which one would be the one that, you know, I can on my own know that I came into this at this state and I kind of did what I need to do. And for me, that was healthcare, subsets, pediatrics. And I did a, you know, mystery window shopping to the different practices, many of them not taking kids with Medicaid and things like that. Many of those families on government insurance, relying on the emergency room as their primary care. There were some few facilities that were adapted them, but they are stretched to the limit. Mm. And based on that, we just kind of did a market analysis and then say, you know what? What would happen is that we would do a pediatric clinic business and we will have multiple locations that are serving the other people. And it's been an amazing experience. It's been fantastic. It's been a lot of work. Lots and lots of work. But, you know, we have a faith, we have our effort, we have our success. And, you know, for me also, success and greatness, everything is internal. It is not what I achieve. It is not what people see. It is who I am. So I basically took who I am to provide services to the people in the area. And then that's how I was in. And so even though I was in Mississippi, this is what I tell myself. There's one of the Tony Robbins conference that I did virtually. So I've had Tony Robbins come to Mississippi to come talk to me.
He came all the way.
And John Maxwell come to Mississippi. So I do a lot of time and effort that I spend building myself. So even though anyone could look at it and say, Mississippi? But I think I was able to take sort of that wilderness experience and then just make sure that I have a wonderful, beautiful, flourishing garden in the midst of adversity.
Okay. Again, tying back to what you said in the beginning, opportunities and crisis, right? And I love that. Being able to see you, even when things are not, I mean, you hear Mississippi, it's like, what's that state? But here you are making it work, right? And I think as someone living in Oklahoma, I can always boast of its cost of living and just the family-centered nature of the place itself, you know? I mean, we do have a lot of things we need to work on. But that said, the cost of living is non-parallel, right? A dollar in Oklahoma stretches a long way. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I know when my husband finished his residency, and there were talks of whether he wants to go to be a hospitalist or maybe run his own practice. Running his own practice is still a distant dream, but I know that it comes with a lot of responsibilities. And we've had conversations with, you know, friends and colleagues who have done that. How has it been like for you? Because now the buck stops at, you know, your front step, right? Not just the clinical aspect of it, but also the management, the entrepreneurial aspect of it. For doctors who might be kind of a little bit worried or maybe even scared or filled with trepidation, getting into that line of practice where they are now leading their own practice, what were some things that were very, very helpful for you to conquer whatever fears you had?
I think it comes with the mindset. A lot of people have those ideas and they entertain those ideas, but being an entrepreneur is a totally different mindset from being a clinician. So you have to be able to manage the clinical responsibilities with the business responsibilities and the strategies. And there are lots of physicians that would like to do that. I would say, you know, they can go to our website, manifoldleadership.com. We actually have a service where we support people where some of those questions, concerns, and the things that they have, we just help them dispel it away because we could really help them. So we have helped quite a number of practices in different parts of the country. So we see that as a valuable addition because sometimes physicians don't just need people to bounce things on, people to just clear the doubts, and people that understand what they are going through from the clinical aspect, but then also being able to do well on the business aspect of their dreams. So we are always here to help.
That is amazing. And I imagine that your perspective as, you know, an immigrant and also somebody who has done, you know, the public health and then into clinical care, you can draw from also many angles. So your client portfolio could be very, very vast because you have so many experiences, lived experiences that can help them, you know, they can draw a lot of gems from, I imagine.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. All right. You're so easy to talk to. See, we've gone over time, but I feel like I still have more questions. So that means you have to come back on the podcast. Now, if you could sit down with your younger self at the start of your career, maybe that young man, first stepping into medicine and leadership, what would be the most important thing you would want him to know?
I would want him to be able to paint a picture of the vision that he wants for his or her life and then career and just stick to it. And the reason that I said that is this: when I graduated from med school in 2005, one of the things that I wrote as part of my 10-year vision was that by 2015, I would have achieved the top of being an attending physician in Nigeria and then in the US.
Wow.
And I totally forgot about that vision. I totally forgot about it until when I graduated from residency and it was in 2015. I'm like, oh my God. And that just brought me back, say, look, like this vision thing that I've read about and I've listened to, this thing actually works to have like a 5-year vision and a 10-year vision and something like that. And I'm writing it down and keeping it in a place that you can see it, because sometimes, or many times, there'll be day-to-day things that sway us left and right. But if you have a vision and you stick to it, one day you will get there.
That is so, I mean, thanks for sharing that, by the way. And I agree with you because we do our yearly plan as my husband and I, and then we put it somewhere, you know, where we can see it. Do I see it all the time? No. But there's something about just writing your plans down. You become it, right? Without you even knowing. And then by the time you come back together, at the end of the year, you realize that, wow. I mean, we do like 6 months, you know, check-ins and all that to be sure that, okay, what's working? What can we pivot and all that? But there's a way you have to write it down. And I think it's so biblical. Like, write down the vision. Write it down. And maybe after a while, you start becoming it. Maybe at the back of your mind, you know where the goal is. Even if things are not looking that way. But how do you know where you want to be if you don't write it down?
Absolutely.
Thanks for sharing that. And I think just to bring this back, because I want this to be focused on the men, because again, this is an area I'm very passionate about, to support the men, you know, in my research and in just my processes. Now, for men who might be listening, who might be at those crossroads, you know, like feeling successful, but also they feel unfulfilled or accomplished or even exhausted, what's the first step you recommend they take towards a more balanced, sustainable version of success?
I think every man needs to learn to step back and take a personal evaluation not based on the external things going on, but based on the internal picture that they have or that they should have of themselves and of each aspect of their lives. And just taking time, that time is a time of rest, is a time of reflection, is a time of realignment, and is a time to also strategize. There will be challenges around. There will be a lot of external things that we all need to deal with. But by taking that time back and then just knowing where we want to go, that would really, really help us. And then that would help us to see opportunities, to see things that we need to tweak, things that we need to change. And most importantly, just on your way to your goals, make sure that you take care of yourself so that you get there in one piece.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Now, I just want to say thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I really would like to recommend your Manifold Leadership Program, and we're going to put that in the tag. So I think it's open not just to men, right? It's for just to help with transformational leadership, right?
Yes.
So, yeah, and they do a lot more. They do personal coaching. They do organizational growth. They also have comprehensive behavioral assessments. And for those who might be interested, I'll put that link in the show notes. It's manifoldleadership.com. But for people that might want to reach you and maybe learn more about your process or just get to see how they can gain some form of insight from your leadership style and all that, how can they get access to you? How can they reach you, Dr. Adepoju?
They could go either through the manifoldleadership.com website, or they could go on LinkedIn and search for me, Timi Adepoju, and then just send me a message, and then we would reach out to them and set up time to have the conversation and to keep moving forward.
Okay. And thank you so much once again. I took a lot from our conversation today. I think one of the things I would like to, as a way of recap, is we know that our culture often equates masculine worth with endless, you know, grinding and silent suffering. But you sharing just where strength can include wisdom to care for oneself, and leadership can also encompass leading by example in all areas of life. And judging that by our internal process, not what people think of us or what people expect of us. I also hope that listeners, you can just take the story of grit, you know, moving from Nigeria, despite all of the challenges and the limited resources, making meaningfulness and finding opportunities in crisis, you know, be it recession or having to go through an MPH program and then finally getting into residency. Now serving in one of the states in the U.S. that is chronically underserved with, you know, poor health outcomes, but finding those opportunities to engage in communities and provide care, and also, you know, branch into leadership and equipping people with transformational leadership styles. We hope that this will encourage you to begin your own process or restart something in your life. And as we reflect on so many aspects of today's conversation, I hope you consider this following. What would your life look like if you gave yourself permission to thrive instead of merely survive? What would change if you viewed self-care not as something selfish, but as a mandatory thing to do for sustainable service? And what legacy would you want to leave of one of endless sacrifice or living a balanced, intentional life? The choice, as Dr. Adepoju reminds us today, is not between greatness and self-care. The choice is between a greatness that depletes you and a greatness that sustains you. And in a world that desperately needs healthy, whole leaders, perhaps the most radical thing any of us can do is to choose the path that leads not just to success, but to significance and the energy to enjoy both. Thank you for joining us for this powerful conversation. Until next time, I remain your host. And remember that your greatest contribution may well begin with learning to truly care for the person making it. And thank you, Dr. Adepoju. I really, really enjoyed our time today in the studio, and I really appreciate your time.
Thank you for your time.
All right. I hope this was manageable for you and not too overwhelming. You had so many great points. I just kept asking all the questions.
This is wonderful. And oh my God, your summary at the end. Oh my.
Oh, that's, you gave me the tools for it. I just summarize your word, you know. But those were all your words right there. So thank you for making us shine. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your time. It's been great. You know, I love it. This is one of the things, you know, I thought about it, but I'm like, okay, what am I going to say and things? And I realized that most of the time when I'm just being myself with my friend, I'm able to have the conversation. So that's, you know, maybe that's what I need to do.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I mean, thanks for considering us. I mean, I think the relaxing, you're very relaxed, by the way, but you had so much to say, which is why I just kept asking questions and I went over an hour. Yeah, that's a tip I learned in Toastmasters. Whenever you're giving a public speech and you feel very intimidated, find a friendly face. Now, some people, when they are looking at you, they have this mean face. They're not reacting to you. It's just the way their faces are. But find someone that smiles and always go back to them. Because again, vocal eye contact and varied eye contact is one of the key things they rate you on as an effective leader. So you don't want to be stuck at that person all the time. But scan around, but always keep going back to that source to kind of fill you in. You just, you know, echoed that by saying that. But yeah, this was great.
Thank you so much for your time. Absolutely, would do. Thank you so much. I appreciate you so much. Thank you.